This is Radio Equal Shot with your host, Alex Smith.
You already know the poorest people in the world will suffer most as climate changes, but don't think about overseas. New science finds disadvantaged neighborhoods of America will heat, quote, 2.2 degrees C or 4 degrees Fahrenheit hotter than the wealthiest 10% on both extreme heat days and average summer days, end quote. And I think, or I wonder, that may be true in Europe and Asia as well. Climate change is just plain unfair, whether you call it thermal inequity or deadly heat. From the Geography Graduate Group at the University of California, Davis, we reached the lead author of a new paper, John D'Alessandro, more widely known as Jake. Jake D'Alessandro, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Well, African Americans, Latinx, and other minority communities are already hot about social and economic inequality, and now you say global warming will add unfair burdens as well?
Yeah, this is true. It's very unfortunate, but communities of color and communities of low income are disproportionately affected by excess heat, which is only being exacerbated by climate change and warming temperatures. Unfortunately, it doesn't look like that problem is going to turn around anytime soon, so we're hoping we can take the steps with our research to start to turn that problem around.
I recently spoke with Dr. Li Zhao about his paper, Global Multimodal Projections of Local Urban Climates. And Zhao tells us during this century, the average city temperatures will rise about 4 degrees C or 7 degrees Fahrenheit higher than the year 1900 temperatures. I wonder if the extra heat in the poor neighborhoods that you were talking about will be added to that general urban heat island effect. What do you think?
What we have found and what we have found in some of our models is that due to these neighborhoods not necessarily having the heat seek out these individuals, urban heat certainly isn't looking for, you know, communities of color or low income to make their lives harder. But the inherent urban fabric, and by urban fabric I mean the amount of impervious surface, the lack of vegetation will cause this thermal difference to broaden. So with the paper that you were just referencing, if there's going to be an increase of 7 degrees compared to the 1900 baseline, we can anticipate that this warming will only accumulate greater in these communities of color where there's higher impervious surface. And that's kind of due to basically downwelling solar irradiance having a greater amount of absorption versus reflection. And the basically a percolation, so to speak, of this air temperature warming gradually throughout the day and cooling less at night. So basically, long story short, is that, yes, this will translate into these communities of color and vulnerable populations, unfortunately.
What cities did you study, and how did you define disadvantaged communities?
So we're using the term disadvantaged communities loosely, so I'll just address how we use the term, because there's many definitions that are out there, and I don't want to contradict any other studies that have been really good in bringing this topic and this issue to the forefront. We looked at basically the communities that had the lowest amount of income and the communities that had the highest amount of Latino or Black population. Unfortunately, these communities kind of correlated together, so low-income areas tended to be where these high populations of Latinx and Black communities were. We looked at specifically the 20 largest metropolitan areas in the southwestern United States, and we included the state of California as part of the southwestern U.S., although some people debate that California is not part of the Southwest. We did not do San Francisco strictly because of the maritime influence, that there really isn't a huge heat burden for even low-income communities there just because there's such a cooling influence from the Pacific Ocean. So we did everything from San Diego, Los Angeles, Bakersfield, all the way to the Texas cities of Houston, Austin, San Antonio, El Paso. Even Denver and Salt Lake City were included in our studies.
And there's some great charts in your paper, which I would like people to have a look at. I'll put a link in my blog at ecoshock.org so people can find your paper. So when you find up to 4 degrees Fahrenheit more heat possible in poor neighborhoods, is that a general heat, say, over the summer, or does it change even more during heat waves?
So what we found is that the pattern was actually consistent between an extreme heat event and an average summer day. We were hypothesizing before we began this study that extreme heat would lend itself to have a wider spectrum between the wealthiest and poorest neighborhoods in temperature. We actually found that not to be true. Nonetheless, even an average heat day, there's still this large thermal inequity and an unequal burden that these residents have to heat. So if you were, if I could make an example and say you're in the city of Sacramento and you unfortunately live in a low-income area, and your city experiences a day that is going to be 105 degrees Fahrenheit or let's say 43 degrees Celsius, you're going to actually experience that temperature differently. Your neighborhood's probably going to be more like 45, 46 degrees Celsius. And then if you look more at the wealthier neighborhoods, because there's more tree canopy, more cooling infrastructure, those temperatures may be 41, 42 degrees. And the really unfortunate part of all this is the people that face the greatest amount of heat burden oftentimes have the least amount of resources to combat it or mitigate it. And by that, I mean they don't have the monetary or financial resources to have their electric bill go up 20 or 30% because there was a particularly hot month and they had to run their air conditioner more. They may not even have air conditioning. Access to cooling centers may be limited, especially during the COVID-19 pandemic. I know that's been a big issue in Arizona where people who did not have access to cooling in their own homes also didn't have access to these public spaces that would provide cooling. So, yeah, basically we found that whether it's an extreme heat event or even just an average summer day, the thermal inequity and the thermal burden is still very, very broad.
Doctors and epidemiologists say the deaths go up a couple of days after a heat wave. It's called the harvesting effect. And they warn nighttime temperatures are absolutely critical. Did your study include night temperatures?
We did include nighttime temperatures. Unfortunately, we were using a remote sensing data set that is not the best at using nighttime temperatures. So we use a satellite called Landsat 8, operational land imager and thermal imager. And this provides data at a snapshot in time over an entire study area. While Landsat 8 does provide nighttime temperature, the sensitivity of the other parts of the electromagnetic spectrum does not have a capability to be sensed at night. So our equations and algorithms that are used and were actually created by NASA to create this brightness temperature and then Fahrenheit and Celsius temperatures are not as accurate, and they don't provide as much of the variation that is actually found. So we were really only using a proxy. Nighttime temperatures, I agree, are far more important for individuals experiencing heat waves, especially when it comes to heat-related sickness and mortality. We are hopefully working on getting more data to do a more robust analysis of nighttime temperature. In 2018, NASA and the International Space Station launched EcoStress, which is going to have a much greater capability of mapping nighttime temperature at the metropolitan scale. Another option that we did not use, and this option also has a lot of controversy with it, is using weather station data, but you would have to use an interpolation technique to make a surface of temperature using weather station data, which also introduces some errors. Again, long story short, that we did look at nighttime temperatures. However, our variation that we found, we feel was not as accurate as what the actual variation is, which is why we focused mainly on the daytime temperatures in our study.
So did you look at historical data? I mean, have we already seen and recorded urban heat inequity in America? I presume we have.
You know, it's something that has been somewhat understudied. There has been studies on it, particularly after the 2003 heat wave, actually, in Paris. So not necessarily the United States, but in 1995, there was a horrible heat wave that impacted Chicago. In 2003, there was the European heat wave that unfortunately really took a lot of individuals' lives. So this has been a process that has been mapping, never at the scale that we've done, that we've looked at so many cities and looked at so many neighborhood scales. And by neighborhood scales is we use the American Community Survey, which uses census tract and census block group data to map out how individual neighborhoods are impacted by heat. I would say mapping urban heat is somewhat in its adolescence phase, as I would say is maybe with the use of remote sensing data, about 20 to 30 years old. But it has been mapped before, but we feel never at this type of scale and never with this type of analysis.
Yeah, you mentioned the Chicago heat wave of 1995. Over 700 people died. And one factor, people in high crime areas were afraid to leave a window open so they could get cooler. Many elderly died in closed, overheated rooms. So maybe heat inequity is just part of the big picture of a really unfair society broadly.
I would agree 100% with that statement. It's a piece of the puzzle, but it certainly isn't. It certainly isn't the end all. A lot of the neighborhoods that, you know, we found had this unequal thermal burden or thermal inequity also have an inequity when it comes to air quality, proximity to like Superfund and like environmental sites that have been has toxins and things like along those lines, as well as some of the social factors like crime and poverty that you just mentioned.
And we know humans have a heat limit built into us around 95 degrees wet bulb temperature or 35 degrees C. If an inner city is hotter but maybe drier than the suburbs, maybe the extra heat matters less. I wonder, did your study factor in the combination of humidity and heat?
So we did not look at the psychological perceived temperature or the real field temperature that you're referencing with how the humidity plays a role. In general, our cities all had low humidity values with the exception of Houston and Dallas. So a lot of the southwestern United States have very dry temperatures, which gives you a little bit more of a threshold and a little bit, I don't want to say cushion, but an ability to cope with higher temperatures more if the air is drier. I think we've all heard the phrase, it's hot, but it's a dry heat. And that does ring true when it comes to comfort, but it can still weigh heavily on an individual as they experience this heat. Basically, to answer your question, we did not take humidity into account, but it definitely plays a vital role in this.
When I talked with urban heat expert Matt Santamouris in Australia, he explained heat tolerance is partly based on past experience and expectations. The level of heat where people are hospitalized in London is just another day in Lagos, Nigeria. But we all have the same bodies. So I wonder, is it racial stereotyping when people expect Latinx folks, for example, could take more heat than white people? What do you think?
You know, it's interesting that you said that. The same thing happened in Chicago. Like, that heat wave in Chicago may have been par for the course in Phoenix, Arizona. Your body, when you move to somewhere like a desert, it's not till the second summer that you're really able to help to, like, almost train yourself for the heat. The human body is obviously amazing, and I'm far from, like, a medical doctor that knows a lot about anatomy or anything like that, but I do know that it's almost like a training and detraining of your body. So if you've grown up in an area that's hot and you experience it, it doesn't necessarily have to do with your DNA, but it has to do with, like, how your body has, like, built itself to respond to heat. With that being said, extreme heat waves don't care how much you've experienced heat in the past. If there's going to be an extreme heat event, you know, it's not going to pardon you just because you're new to an area. I think that the example you use with Lagos and London is a very pertinent and very, and fits very well with the United States. You know, some of our temperatures that were being experienced in Albuquerque compared to Tucson, you know, Albuquerque's at, I believe, 1,700 meters above sea level, and Tucson's at 800 meters above sea level, and then Tucson's also further south. So a very hot day in Tucson, if you're a resident of Tucson and suddenly you're experiencing an extreme heat day in Albuquerque, you very well may have had this physiological training to cope with heat just a little bit better. But that doesn't mean you're not susceptible to having these heat-related sicknesses and, God forbid, mortality.
Well, you're also a competitive runner. Did you have to retrain your body a bit to run in the heat?
You know, it's interesting that you said that. When I moved to Las Cruces, New Mexico to do my master's degree, and as a runner, it was the first summer I was there, I struggled a lot. And, you know, kind of my own experience, I did get a lot more comfortable the second summer. But no, for athletes in general, I mean, it's almost like your heart rate is just generally higher when it's hot because your body's working harder to cool you. But yeah, that was my experience personally.
So you studied the U.S. Southwest, which is a pretty hot place, and I look at your study as kind of a preview of the dangerous heat coming unexpectedly to cities further north as the climate warms. Hardly anybody in the northern hemisphere is going to be immune if global mean temperatures go up more than 3 degrees C in a century. That's over 5 degrees Fahrenheit. Would you agree that thermal inequity will become everyone's problem?
You know, I do feel that it will become everyone's problem because with the climate change data that you presented earlier in our conversation, you know, that really hot day is now going to be like a cooler day. So if you're in a very nice community where you don't really experience a huge extreme heat event, you know, if it's going to increase 7 degrees Fahrenheit or 3 degrees Celsius, your neighborhood that was 42 degrees and maybe like not getting quite the brunt of a heat wave, even though you're still the coolest part of the city, now you're 45, 46 degrees Celsius. So, yeah, I agree. I think it's going to be everyone's problem. The one thing I would like to say, though, is for those of us who are fortunate enough to be able to turn our air conditioner on, you know, not everyone has that luxury. And even with the warming of the temperatures, the luxury of having the AC is going to play a vital role. If you're going to pay for your rent or you're going to pay for running the air conditioner, and you only can do one or the other, you're going to pay for your rent. That just really can be so detrimental for your health, unfortunately. And it's something that we need to figure out so everyone can be as comfortable as possible and, you know, avoid these heat-related sicknesses. But it will become everyone's problem, like you said. Absolutely.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex with our guest, Jake D'Alessandro, talking about climate injustice as we heat up the world. Jake, what factors make disadvantaged neighborhoods so much hotter than wealthy communities?
That's interesting that you bring that up, because it's not that they're just it's not that heat is not seeking out any individual socio-demographic. It comes down to amount of green space, and by green space it could be anything from a park that's irrigated with a lot of grass to amount of tree canopy. Tree canopy is the best way to cool your city. Unfortunately, nothing is free in this. So you have to trade like water resources to have a lot of trees. Trees cool by shading, trees cool by evaporation. So you can't just go to Phoenix, Arizona and make it a forest, or you can't go to Albuquerque and make it a forest. Also, lack of a smart building infrastructure. So there's like a lot of impervious surface, even everything down to like the albedo. And by albedo, I mean the amount of reflectivity. You know, if you have like black asphalt tar roofs and black asphalt concrete parking lots, those are going to heat up more. And those are much more common in these low-income neighborhoods. It just comes down to those two things, the urban fabric and the amount and configuration of urban green spaces.
I recall Matt Santamaris also measured big heat differences within a short distance because of what you were just talking about. It was over 150 degrees Fahrenheit on the upper deck of a car park in Darwin, Australia, in a sounding 65 degrees C. But underneath a nearby tree, the temperature was under 100 degrees Fahrenheit. Just planting trees could be big help, but as you say, we can't do that in some of the places we need it more, and trying to keep those trees alive in blistering heat waves is also going to be a challenge. So if we do nothing much, I wonder, Jake, would the real costs to society in hospitalizations and lost productivity be higher than trying to make some neighborhoods cooler for everyone?
That's where policy comes into play, because it is very costly, and these cities don't have these resources necessarily to be like, oh, well, I really need to, you know, target all my entire city. I need to make every area that does not have shade. I need to create shade there. That's where I think heat priority needs to come into play. You know, since a vast majority of the hospitalizations and the sickness and unfortunate mortalities happen in certain areas in these groups, the cities need to prioritize those areas to prevent them. It's similar to what we're doing with inoculation for the vaccine of COVID-19. You want to inoculate and help the people who are the most vulnerable. Now, you mentioned the trade-off of costs to cities. By prioritizing these areas, I think you can mitigate the cost as well as mitigating the detrimental effects that heat has.
Well, the old standby for the crowded poor in New York City was to open a fire hydrant and let people get wet. It's so crude, but we have to do something. What are some of the other things that we could do to help everyone stay cool in a city, including the poorest areas?
It all starts with the amount of resources that you do have and allocating those. So I think the best way to do that is to look at where the areas are the warmest and start there. If it's an area and it's, let's say it's the researcher that you mentioned in Darwin, let's say this neighborhood's experiencing 65 degrees Celsius temperatures. We need to start there. And by start there, it's like, well, what are we going to do? Okay, well, what is causing the heat here? For example, it was on top of that parking garage where it was just nothing but concrete absorbing all that heat. What could you do to maybe make it a little bit more reflective? So like you change like the albedo of the surface just enough so instead of it being 65 degrees, now it's 62 degrees Celsius. And then it's like, oh, well, now let's plant a little bit of a drought-resistant tree canopy. Maybe like even palm trees can provide somewhat of shade. Or I shouldn't say palm trees, but drought-tolerant species. And it starts with those two things. Those are the easiest. Those are the low-hanging fruit here. And next it goes into policy. Like, how can we make sure that if we can't mitigate the temperatures enough that people are still going to experience them, what type of cooling infrastructure can we provide? Can we provide more public cooling centers? You know, obviously we can't congregate in big crowds right now, but if you're in Darwin, if you're in Phoenix, if you're in, you know, Riyadh, if you're in any one of these areas throughout the world, like if you're nowhere where it's the hottest, can we provide one area where people can go to get just a brief reprieve from this heat? And, you know, maybe all it takes is just like a couple hours of a break so your body can kind of re-regulate and you don't get as sick and you're not as susceptible to illness. Things along those lines. There's so many things that can be done, and But it's going to take an intersection or a nexus between the researchers, the policymakers, the stakeholders, and city planners.
Well, I think, too, we could change our building codes because the homes in North America and Northern Europe were built to keep heat in the winter and not really to be as cool as homes, say, built in the Middle East or Africa. So now we have to use air conditioning. It's taking over. But when the electricity goes off during heat waves, which is common in California, the poorest suffer the most. Have you encountered any data on whether critical power goes off more or longer in low-income areas? That would be neat to know.
You know, I agree 100%. I personally do not know anything about that data or how to access it, but now that you've mentioned it, it's something that I think needs to be included in our future studies. Like, I think that's, like, I don't want to use the word phenomenal because this is, like, a very unfortunate subject, but that's a very important idea and something that needs to be addressed and at the very least, research to find out what neighborhoods get their power knocked off first when a grid gets overpowered. You know, a month ago we had the freeze that happened in Texas, so kind of the opposite end of the spectrum. But people were unfortunately freezing to death because of the opposite problem. And in California would have the same problem, but it would be because of heat instead of the cold. I have not looked into the data at that, and I don't know where to access that, if it is publicly available, if it's going to definitely take some research. But long story short, I think that data is very vital to the equation, and it's something that we need to look into personally.
Well, another policy idea I'm just going to throw out there would be a heat equity tax leveled by a city or a state to pay for the infrastructure we've been talking about to save lives in low-income zones. Maybe we could measure actual temperatures and levy the tax based on how much cooler upscale neighborhoods are. Do you have any thoughts as you work your way through this on how society can pay for the changes we need for thermal equity?
You know, your idea is something that, you know, it's a tax that would maybe help balance everything out. And like that tax could go towards these disadvantaged. What you suggested would be one of the very many tools in the artillery for combating this problem. If you were able to somehow find or implement, you know, temperature gauges and readings throughout the city that can consistently collect data and show like, okay, like looking at throughout the daily or annual cycle, these neighborhoods are always hardest by the temperatures. And these neighborhoods are always at the lowest end of the histogram of temperatures. These people who live in these areas where it's cooler, you know, they maybe provide a tax. Maybe there should be some sort of tax for the cooling. And it would go towards maybe smoothing the thermal inequity. So every resident has an equal chance at a comfortable and heat-related mortality and sickness-free life.
Yeah, I could see that as the climate warms, we're going to find more people in impacted communities organizing against uncontrolled climate change or against the hot circumstances they're living in. Maybe that'll become a social pressure point leading to protests and unrest. What do you think?
I think it's a topic that is going to be becoming more front page news, especially as we become more environmentally conscious. And two, as we kind of enter this mid-century portion and late century where all these climate projections are going to start impacting everybody and then impacting the most vulnerable even more. I would have to say that I agree that it's going to be at the forefront. And the sooner we address it, the better, to make everyone's lives better.
Jake, what are you working on now or what will you work on next?
You know, our next step in our process is we're actually going to look at modeling how we can cool a city most efficiently through the use of, you know, building intensity and tree canopy layers and, you know, more temperature data. You know, if we're going to look at, like, the city of Los Angeles, we're going to, like, look at, like, let's say the city of Los Angeles currently has 9% tree canopy throughout the city. If we were to up that to 30% and we were to put that extra 21% of tree canopy in the most vulnerable communities, what would be the temperature outcome at mid-century or even currently if we were to just implement that? That's what we're diving into pretty heavily right now. It would be the next steps. We're also looking to obtain data like access to air conditioning to see like how that correlates or what type of pattern there is between access to AC and simply exposure to heat. And then also, it looks like we got some new ideas from our conversation just now of kind of looking into more data sets of who is disproportionately impacted by these blackouts, especially during extreme climate events.
From UC Davis, we've been speaking with John, or Jake D'Alessandro, about unfair heat hitting the poorest neighborhoods. He is the lead author of the January 2021 study titled Dimensions of Thermal Inequity, Neighborhood Social Demographics, and Urban Heat in the Southwestern U.S. Jake, thank you for talking us through this.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
We all look forward to summer, but how about endless summer? 6 months of the hottest days you ever lived. Tune in again next week as we explore more science of the coming times. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening and caring about this world.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.